Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host filling in for Dr. Christy Page, Dr. Jessica Anderson. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great. It's always great to have one of our resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine and hear your thoughts. Particularly, we're going to be talking about some research today that I think you're going to have some opinions about how long residents should work.
Yes, it'll be really interesting. I'm excited.
Well, we're also going to talk about some other research that matters dealing with Planned Parenthood and defunding and what impact that has on health, about physical activity and falls in older men, and about gun-related violence. And then we're going to be talking with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University, about the Zika virus. I'm sure you've heard a lot about Zika virus, as we all have in the last few weeks.
Oh, definitely. I'm really excited about hearing her conversation.
You know, and I think that it's a natural thing to perhaps panic, but I think she may give us a voice of calm. At least I hope so. Mm-hmm. We'll see. Well, let's talk first about our first research that matters. And this is a study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine about what impact of removing Planned Parenthood from the Texas Women's Health Program. What's that study about?
So basically, the study was measuring the impact of removing Planned Parenthood from Texas Women's Health Program and what impact that has other than, you know, the biggest controversy between removing these for people who don't believe in, like, abortion services versus really realizing all of the possible things that they offer, including contraceptive services for women.
Right. Like, we think of Planned Parenthood perhaps because of the politicized nature that it's only about abortions, as you say. Mm-hmm. But the reality is they provide a tremendous amount of contraceptive services and general women's health care to oftentimes very poor women who don't have access, could be disproportionately Medicaid or uninsured. And so this is some interesting research because this is actually just kind of a natural experiment that Planned Parenthood in Texas was defunded and they shifted the services to a different clinic arrangement. And what sort of outcomes did they find?
There's concern that this is increasing the risk of unintended pregnancies.
Right. And they found that there was a 27% increase in the rate of deliveries paid for by Medicaid among women who had received these injectable contraceptives. And they also found fewer claims now were being made for these injectable contraceptives. There were no changes in birth control pills, patches, rings, other sorts of hormonal contraception, which should suggest that a lot of the women who were getting services, who perhaps were on these long-acting contraceptives, who were perhaps not getting pregnant, that they now were getting pregnant and there was a lot more deliveries, not necessarily intended deliveries or not. We can't really tell. This is a little concerning to me. I don't know how you think about it.
Yeah, it is certainly very concerning. And the U.S. continues, we know, to have higher rates of unintended pregnancies than most rich nations. And this potentially also contribute to that.
Yeah. And I think ultimately the conversation should shift really not about abortion. Is this about provision of services, legal services to women? And
right.
Because the reality is, if we shut down clinics for the procedure that we don't like, that's legal. My opinion is it's unintended consequences. In this particular case, you have potentially a lot fewer on access to safe and effective pregnancy prevention.
Certainly.
Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, Jessica. And this is about physical activity in falls. Are you physically active, Jessica?
I try to be.
What's your favorite physical activity?
Running.
Oh, I like to run too.
Yes.
And I must say that when I don't run, I feel less fit. And sometimes I think if I'm more physically active, perhaps I don't stumble when I'm going up steps, up or down, and I might not fall as much. I don't know. But it's pretty good as I start to get older and you see among our patients, I'm sure you've cared for a lot of patients who have had falls.
Definitely. It's probably one of the most frequent things we see just coming in on our inpatient service in the hospital.
And so what was the idea? This was a study that was in the British Medical Journal and is one of the largest studies of people who could possibly be at risk for falls in a study to try to prevent these falls. What was it about?
So they found that in men, with moderate physical activity, the likelihood of a serious fall injury was reduced 38%. They also found a reduction in fall-related fractures of 53% and a 59% reduced rate of fall injuries leading to hospitalization.
Those are pretty significant findings. They didn't find the same thing in women, but they did find that the men had really done a more extensive increasing physical activity than the women. And this was moderate walking, flexibility, strength, and balance training, all of which in the men improved. This is pretty amazing stuff
it
here.
Is.
You know, I bet if we said we had a pill, Jessica, and we could give that pill to people and it would lead to a 50% reduction in fall-related fractures and injuries and hospitalizations, a lot of my patients, and even I might say, I'd take that pill.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And this pill is physical activity.
Right. And we're finding more and more things that actually improve with physical activity. Blood pressure, sugar in people with diabetes, and so.
Yeah, and they didn't even have to go running. They just did the moderate walking.
Right.
I love it. I love it. Our next research that matters is something I don't love. It's kind of depressing, really, but we have to talk about it. And it's the gun-related murder rates in the United States. And this was research that was in the American Journal of Medicine. And the statistics in this are sad and depressing.
Very much so. They actually found that Americans are 7 times more likely to die from violence and 6 times more likely to be accidentally killed with a gun.
Compared to these other high-income countries.
Right.
There are 22 other high-income countries, and the gun-related murder rate in the United States was 25 times higher than these other high-income nations.
Right. And in the U.S., we actually have the most firearms per capita in the world.
It's really amazing. I mean, if you look at, for instance, children under 14 who die by gun violence, 91% of these children were in the United States compared to these other 22 countries. Those between age 15 to 24, 92% of those who were killed by guns were in the United States. And murder is the second leading cause of death among Americans age 15 to 24.
That is just shocking.
It's just shocking. You know, we have to do better.
Right.
Whether we get to the answers today, we have to do better. And I think the laws that are designed to disquiet physicians from talking about this are things that we need to speak out on. And we need to talk and find common solutions, I'm hoping. Let's talk really briefly about our last research that matters. I think you have an opinion about it. This has to do that with research in the New England Journal of Medicine about whether surgery residents could work more than 28 hours or not, because that's the limit right now. Is that correct?
That is correct. We are constantly having conversations about this within the residency program and residency programs across the U.S. about whether or not we should be working really long hours, whether this is affecting our patient care
and
our health.
And the continuity of care and your health, because if you drive home and you're sleeping, you fall asleep, or you're doing a procedure and you're really sleepy and you don't do it as well, or you make mistakes and orders, all of these kind of things. And so they had work hour reforms, but the surgery residents in particular, they could be in the middle of a surgery.
Right.
And not wanting to have to break from the surgery. So what did they find? What was what they found?
What they found in this study is that although even when doctors were or residents were going over these long hours, they're avoiding the loss of critical information if they're able to kind of have that continuity with their patients. Also, avoiding a break in the doctor-patient relationship.
Well, this is what they think is really what happened, and they're hypothesizing. But over 4,000 residents, 120 programs, 151 hospitals, 140,000 patients, they said the outcomes were similar whether the residents stuck to the guidelines or worked longer shifts, implying exactly as you say, Jessica, that perhaps there should be more flexibility in the guidelines. You could also argue the opposite side, right? The outcomes weren't better, so therefore, why not keep it the same? And of course, they say some of the surgery residents, well, they want the ability to work longer. Do you want that ability?
Well,
do you want more flexibility or not? No, I'm this is a great question.
In some situations, I think there are benefits to having the flexibility to work longer hours. You do learn a lot more. You have that continuity of seeing a patient throughout any intervention that you do. From the same token, you just also have to think of the health of the residents and their outside happiness and what they're able to kind of give their patients what they need to give.
Yeah, I worry at times that we might be making it incumbent upon the resident who's always going to want to please potentially the attending or make it bad if they don't want to do that. So I do worry about opening up this can of worms, but it's been open. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We talked about work hours reform. We've talked about murder rates. We've talked about falls among men and about Planned Parenthood and contraceptive services for women. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University about the Zika virus transmission research and prevention. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Anderson. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, I'll have a chance to talk with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University, about the Zika virus transmission, research, and prevention. Welcome, Dr. Harrington. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You know, I should first just say, Dr. Harrington, how did you get interested in entomology? Let's just start there. This is not something that I think everyone would know how someone gets interested and becomes a career as an entomologist.
Well, as a kid, I was a 4-H member, and I had an insect collection as part of my 4-H project, and I got interested in insects from there. And then I took an entomology course later when I was in college, and was really fascinated by it, and being able to combine entomology with studying vector-borne diseases was really appealing to me, so I went on to graduate school in that area.
You know, I think we're certainly grateful that you did. When you say vector-borne diseases, help us understand, listeners who kind of understand that when one gets bitten by something, one can get infected, but that's not fully all that you're talking about.
Yeah, so typically a vector is an insect that conveys a pathogen or parasite from one host to the other. The types of vectors that I study are mosquitoes, and they're important biologically as what we call vectors. They will pick up a pathogen when they feed on an infected animal or person, and that pathogen will replicate and multiply within the mosquito. And in most cases, it eventually reaches the salivary glands of the mosquito. They have very well-developed salivary glands because they spit a lot. They inject saliva into the host under the skin when they're feeding. And that's the process by which pathogens and parasites, viruses like Zika virus, for example, can be injected into a new host.
I know we're going to talk about the Zika virus in just a second, but I think one of the diseases that most people would be familiar with, though perhaps less so in the United States, would be malaria as one of the ones that would be more famously known of vector-borne. Is this the sort of disease we're really talking about, that things that have been around for a long time and transmitted and difficult to get rid of?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are a lot of different types of infections that are vector-borne that can impact human health, and most of them have been around for a long time. But they're just recently what we call re-emerging, or they're moving into new areas. In some cases, they're changing slightly. Their genetic makeup has shifted or changed a little bit, and they've become more of an issue for public health.
Well, let's jump in with talking about the Zika virus. I would say, venture to say that 2 months ago, the great majority of people in the United States and maybe many countries of the world had maybe never heard of Zika virus, but it's not a new virus.
No, it's not. It's been around for a long time. It was first described in the 1940s from samples in Africa, and then shortly thereafter, it was described in a human patient. So that's when it was described, but that's around the time when our ability to detect viruses first was apparent. And so that's why a lot of these viruses were first described in the 30s and 40s. So we think it's been in Africa a long time. It's been in Asia at least since the early 1900s through a large part of Asia, Southeast Asia. And it's just recently that it's appeared in this hemisphere, probably starting with an outbreak in Easter Island and then movement from there to South America.
So is this virus really been, do we think, in, let's say, areas of the United States, or is this something that's just now be emerging? So it's kind of moving around the world.
Well, I mean, I think in this part of the world, it's new. It's been in Africa and Asia for quite some time, but it's new to the Americas. And that's one of the reasons that we're seeing so many cases and the outbreak has been so explosive, because nobody has any immunity to this new virus. And so a lot of people are getting infected, and a lot of people are infectious from mosquitoes as a source of the virus to pick it up and transmit it to other people.
So let's trace how this works. Let's start with an infected mosquito. What happens?
Yep. So an infected mosquito goes and seeks out a blood meal. And I should add that I've been working on the Aedes aegypti mosquito, that's common name is the yellow fever mosquito, for almost 20 years now. And it's a very interesting mosquito. It's different than other mosquitoes. It actually takes a blood meal feeds on humans, I should say, much more frequently than other types of mosquitoes. So what it does is it has the ability to use blood from humans for energy as well as for producing eggs, which is really important for the female mosquito. And so what happens if you have one of these infected mosquitoes, our work has shown that it's feeding just about every other day on humans. We know that once it's infected with a virus like Zika virus, it's infected for life. And so as long as that female lives, she has the potential to transmit the virus to other people when it takes a blood meal.
And then once an infected mosquito bites a human, that human stands a decent chance of getting infected. Is that correct?
That's correct. So from then, the virus, as the mosquito feeds, remember that the virus is in the saliva and the salivary glands. And so as it's starting to take a blood meal, it will move around under the skin with its mouth parts, and it will salivate, and it will inject virus while it's salivating. And then that virus will get into the bloodstream. It will start to infect the human host. It can be anywhere from 2 to as many as 10 days before the individual will start to feel ill, if they feel ill at all. So only about 20% of people who contract Zika virus actually have any type of symptoms. And then eventually that individual will recover from the virus. Virus will develop antibodies, but they won't have any active live virus in their system.
And while that person is infected, if they get bit by a mosquito that doesn't have the Zika virus, can that mosquito then become a vector and then infect others?
Yes. So as long as they have a person who's infected has what we call viremia, or they have virus circulating in their bloodstream, a mosquito can pick it up and become infected. Now, in the mosquito, just like in the human, there's a lag time before the mosquito can be infectious and actually transmit the virus to other people. And that time period is very tightly linked with the temperature, because mosquitoes are cold-blooded animals, and everything, all of their body functions and their growth is dependent on the temperature. So at high temperatures, that can be fairly fast. And within as little as 5 or 6 days, the mosquito might have virus in its salivary glands and be able to infect another person. And it can take as long as anywhere out to 12 days, depending if it's cooler and the rate of virus replication is lower.
Well, I know we're going to need to take a short break, but I know when we come back, we'd really like to know how is it or what's the risk for someone who has the Zika virus and how is that transmitted? Perhaps is it transmitted from human to human or not? And we hear cautions about sexual transmission. We know about some data about the bad outcomes that can occur to people or particularly pregnant or newborns. And maybe dispel some myths from what we do know and what things that people can do to protect themselves. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to continue having our conversation with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University, about the Zika virus, transmission, research, and prevention. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gulston. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Been talking with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University, about the Zika virus transmission, research, and prevention. And in our first segment, Dr. Harrington, you really laid out, I think, a real good understanding for how this transmission occurs to humans and the kind of the increase transmission of this spread, really. And I guess one question is that the World Health Organization is estimating that 3 to 4 million people could be infected with Zika just this year, which seems like a massive change. Is this a game changer, or is this something that we are just going to have to see and deal with more and more?
Well, I do believe that we are going to start seeing new viruses like Zika more and more frequently. We are no longer isolated. We're truly a global world. We have people moving around, potentially infected, who can bring viruses to new areas. And we have mosquito vectors that are moved around. So there are certainly other viruses waiting in the wings that we should be thinking about and talking about. And I don't want to scare people too much, but I just think it's always prudent to be planning ahead and thinking ahead rather than being reactive to these situations.
Well, I know you're an entomologist, but I've also, it seems that one of the major health considerations of the Zika virus is on unborn children and so pregnant women. And then the other people who may get it, the 1 out of 5 infected, it's a more likely to be a mild viral type infection. Is that true in terms of, or are there things that we don't know and should be worried about? Because if it seems like that would be sufficient, because anyone pregnant or getting pregnant, this is a major concern.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big questions is why we're seeing such a focus in Brazil with microcephaly, which is the condition that we're seeing where children who are exposed to the virus in the womb theoretically have underdeveloped brains, which can lead to long-lasting disability. That is a correlation, but to date there's no new information on what's causing, what the exact relationship is between Zika virus and exposure and this condition. And so I think that's a really big question. And why are we just seeing it really in this focal area in Brazil? And I think that's a really important question. I know that there are a lot of scientists, and that's going to be very important for us in order to understand risk and prevention moving forward.
Well, you do and have done extensive research on these vector-borne mosquitoes and research with dengue and West Nile and chikungunya viruses, and all of them are really prevalent in Central and South America and certainly could spread to the United States, but none of them have done on what we would think like this large epidemic pandemic scale. Is Zika different, And what can we learn from that type of research on other mosquito-borne diseases?
Well, I think Zika is a little bit different here. And ironically, the fact that only a small proportion of people even have symptoms makes it more dangerous, because you can potentially have people who feel fine, they're moving about, doing, you know, their normal daily activities, but they can infect mosquitoes. And so I think that that makes it a little more dangerous. I do think there are some similarities here. I think it's prudent to look at areas where we've already had local transmission in the states of dengue virus in order to understand areas that are at highest risk, because we're dealing with the same vector, a similar type of virus where there are no other reservoirs other than humans, to really try to hone in on those areas. So there are similarities and there are differences. One of the things that's really interesting about chikungunya virus is that it definitely did mutate and change. The viral genetic code changed in a way that made it more easy to be transmitted by the Asian tiger mosquito, and that led to really an explosive outbreak. And I think that we should be aware of that. There hasn't been a lot of talk about the Asian tiger mosquito, but it's a very good vector of dengue, of chikungunya, and we think probably Zika. The experiments haven't been completed yet and haven't been reported in the peer-reviewed literature, but I'm anticipating that we'll find that the Asian tiger mosquito is a very good vector of Zika. That mosquito has a much, much broader range within the United States. And so I think we really need to keep an eye on that.
Well, I know, like any listener, I've never yet discovered a great use for mosquitoes in my life. And I know that having had them around water and when there are milder winters, such as the one we've gone through, that it seems that they're worse in the next summer. What can we really do that helps us, from your knowledge and maybe research, prevent bites? And is that right now the best thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of mosquitoes in the world. We have about 3,500 species, actually. And it's really just a handful of them that really are important to public health. Even though it's just a handful, they're very diverse. And so I think we really need to know what species are important in transmission, and then we can target things like prevention. So, for example, with the vectors of Zika virus, they're day-active mosquitoes. So those messages that people get about West Nile, for example, to avoid mosquitoes at dusk and dawn, are not going to apply here. We're talking about a mosquito that feeds during the day. And so I think, you know, one of the most important things we can do as scientists and public health officials is to find out what the vector is and give people much more detailed information about risk. And then, unfortunately, there's not a lot that can be done to control. These particular mosquitoes we're talking about today are container breeding mosquitoes. So they'll breed in discarded trash, artificial containers that fill up in your yard. They can even breed in rain gutters on the eaves of your home. And they can be very difficult to find. And so they're notoriously difficult to control.
Do the sprays that people use seem to have impact, where people will spray around the periphery in the yard to control mosquito eggs? Does that do anything for this sort of transmission?
It's not very helpful. I mean, it's better than nothing, you know, and that's important. But in reality, what they're doing is they're spraying insecticide in a very, very small little droplets, very, very tiny droplets of insecticide, and what has to happen is those droplets need to hit a mosquito body in order to kill it. And that can be very difficult. These mosquitoes are resting, you know, on trees and in protected spaces. This mosquito loves to get indoors in people's homes, and, the insecticide spray is not going to target them very efficiently.
Well, you know, I think we have just maybe time for kind of one kind of final thought. And I'd be curious, as a researcher, but also potentially as a sister, parent, mother, whatever the role might be, what do you recommend to people? and looking for advice, but also just what to do.
Well, I would say don't panic too much. I mean, I think it's important to keep this all in perspective. And one of the best lines of defense right now are repellents, to be honest. We have some very good repellents on the market that are very safe that we can use, and that's really important. And, you know, making sure that your screens are in good repair, you know, making sure that you minimize exposure with these mosquitoes that are day active is the best, really the best line of defense right now.
And if you have a long sleeve shirt, the only and long pants, the only area of thing would be anything exposed, probably.
Right.
Yeah. So. Well, I think we really appreciate. There's lots of questions, many more questions than answers, but you've started providing your listeners with some of the answers, and I think they can appreciate at least feeling a little bit more knowledgeable. And where would you recommend people go for more information?
Well, actually, the Centers for Disease Control has a very good informative website. If you go to www.cdc.gov/Zika, Z-I-K-A, people will find quite a bit of information as well as some updates on what's happening with Zika virus.
Well, we'll put that on our website. And again, we want to thank you so much for talking with us today. We've been talking with Dr. Laura Harrington, medical entomologist and chair of the Department of Entomology at Cornell University, about the Zika virus. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, Christy and Abel answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And Jessica, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today. I think it's about the flu.
Is it too late in the season for me to get a flu shot? It seems like every week someone new at work is out with the flu. It's not spreading through the office, but it's gotten me thinking about getting the shot. But will it do me much good this late in the season?
Oy. What do you think, Jessica? I think this is a pretty simple answer.
Yeah, so it's never too late to get the flu shot. You always could potentially have some protection. The flu season is still will be going on for another couple months.
And we're seeing a lot of it right now. We've seen very little flu in the region of the country that North Carolina is in. Perhaps other areas of the country have seen a lot more, and internationally, of course. But the reality is it will offer the protection. And particularly if you're around people at risk, elderly or children, or, you know, there's so many different risk groups, chronic disease. We are strong proponents. We believe that it's helpful. So downside, I'm not sure there really is a downside.
Me neither.
Yep. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 60-year-old male, and I'm overweight, and I have high blood pressure. But I'm trying to be healthier this year, and I want to run a 10K in the summer. I'm training for it by running twice a week, but I want to be sure it's safe for me and my heart to run. Do you have any recommendations?
First of all, I want to say congratulations for taking the initiative to make this change.
Ditto.
Yeah, that's a great first step. Second of all, so there are some questions potentially whether have you ran before? Is this going to be kind of a new thing for you? If there are any concerns, I would certainly recommend going to see your doctor and making sure that there's nothing you need to be worried about for increasing your physical activity.
Yeah, I say start low and go slow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about each of those. What is starting low? Well, if you're running two times a week, but you're running a half mile at a time, well, that's probably pretty low. But if you're running that half mile in, let's say, 5 minutes, that's probably a good pace to start with. And you can build those things up. You know, there's the worst thing that could happen is you get an injury, or that in your case that you get chest pain or something more likely. You're probably doing pretty good as a start, though. And boy, what a great thing to a way of cutting down on your blood pressure and losing some weight potentially. and becoming more physically fit. Any other tips that you have from, because I know you're a runner.
Yeah, I think the starting low and going slow is a great option, particularly if you need to kind of go from walking to running, maybe going back and forth a little bit until you get a little bit more comfortable. So maybe walking 10 minutes and running for 10 minutes and just kind of doing it in intervals sometimes makes it a little bit easier to start with.
What's the furthest you've ever run?
A half marathon.
Over 13 miles.
Yeah.
Longest I did was, listeners might know, I did the 10-mile run, the Tar Heel 10-miler. And when I was training for that, I had not run in a long time, so I started running. But I would go, you know, I might run a half mile, then I might walk a quarter mile, run a quarter mile. Mm-hmm. You know, and I did this walk, run, walk, run. A lot of it was on the treadmill. Yeah. But I found that just kind of getting a longer distance. So even the walking, I think you intimated, could work really well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
There are definitely health benefits for
that. And you can always work with a coach, get a partner, run with you. Nothing like having a misery loves company. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I work a job that involves sitting at a computer for most of the day. I keep hearing these recommendations that for every hour you sit, you should spend X minutes walking. What does that walking do, and does it really make a health difference?
Well, I think it makes a huge difference. I think we've got pretty good research that we've talked about on the show and probably will continue to talk about that when you're sedentary, you actually, that's associated with all kinds of bad health outcomes like heart disease, like high blood pressure, like diabetes. I mean, there's just things that aren't good about just being sedentary.
Right. I definitely agree with that.
And at the same time, how often should you be active even when you're even if you're sitting at a desk? It seems to me that it's not reasonable to be sitting for longer than an hour without getting up and doing some movement, because there's also what's called a burn factor. Have you ever heard that when you run, let's say a mile, and you stop running, you continue to burn some calories for a good while after that? But I imagine the flip side is true, that if you're sedentary for a long time, if you don't get up and do something, you don't get that burn factor started. So I think if you were every 5 minutes, once an hour, get up and did some movement, that actually could be really beneficial to you, maybe even more so than that 20-minute once a day. I think it's good to be more physically active for lots of different reasons. I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
No downside.
No, definitely not.
What's our very last house call today?
My mother has been dizzy for the past few weeks. My friend said her mother was dizzy as well and had a stroke. Should my mom get an MRI or a CAT scan?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if our answer will be so great because we can't go into the details. You'd want to know a lot of questions.
There's a lot of questions that we want to kind of ask your mom about to further figure out exactly what's going on, if she's had any additional symptoms, any nausea, any weakness in any part of her body.
Dizziness, throwing up. I mean, all kinds of things that would signify. What you're looking for is something that signifies a stroke.
Right.
Something that signifies something different about this. Because dizziness is one of the most common complaints. You must see someone who's dizzy every time you're in clinic.
Yeah, probably so.
And most of these things are not strokes.
Right.
So you don't need to do CAT scans or MRIs. But distinguishing the one that's different, and that's going to be probably in your examination. You'd probably want to see this
usually
patient,
physical
wouldn't you?
Examination would probably be the most important for this patient.
Yeah, we would encourage you to perhaps have your mother seen by their primary care provider. That's a good, solid advice. Well, that's going to really conclude all that we can talk about on our house calls today. And we want to thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share your questions at yourhealth.unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or Health App. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great guest co-host today, Dr. Jessica Anderson, and our guest today, Dr. Laura Harrington. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Jessica Anderson. We look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine.